This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Hide.
In today's society, there are few subjects that are more divisive than pornography. In the past, pornography has overwhelmingly been assumed to be a problem in society. However, there is a new research project about to be undertaken which looks at why people actually watch, what they watch, and what motivates them to do so. To discuss this further is Dr. Clarissa Smith from the University of Sunderland in the United Kingdom. Dr. Smith, welcome to Hide and Seek.
Hi, Dean. Thanks for having me on.
That is my pleasure. Now, Clarissa, you've done research into pornography before. In fact, I think that's what your doctorate was about, was it not?
Yes, it was. Yes, my doctorate was an investigation into a pornographic magazine for women, and it looked at how the magazine was made, who made it, why they thought it was necessary, and what readers made of it, and women readers, so some gay men as well.
Why is pornography so ever present in today's society, and why is it necessary?
Well, there are lots of reasons for porn being around. Well, of course, the internet has made a phenomenal difference. It means that actually it's very accessible, it's very available to people. There's no difficulties about going to purchase it now, or not the difficulties that there used to be. So, of course, there's been a big explosion because of that. It means that actually you can buy or download or just go and view pornography of all kinds, so gay, straight, whatever, every taste seems to be catered for. The reasons why it's considered such a problem are partly to do with things like access. In the past, it could be kept out of the way from people, locked in secret museums, as Walter Kendrick called it, or only available to those who could actually afford or had the means to travel to places where they could purchase it. And now, of course, what we've got is access in the home at any time and without any of the problems of embarrassment or being found out that might have happened previously. So there are lots of people, of course, who think that access is a problem simply because they would rather people didn't have interest in sexuality or in sexual materials. But, of course, sexuality is a massive part of most people's lives. You know, it doesn't have to be the important thing in people's lives, but it is important to people. It's about intimacy. It can be about expressing oneself. It can be, you know, about one's identity. And so, you know, of course, it's a very important and very potent force because of that.
It continues to astound me that we have censorship laws that seem to be getting more and more tougher to try and filter out pornography, and yet at the same time it becomes more and more ever-present, and inherently it is within our very nature to be sexual beings.
Yes, I think that's probably very true, that actually, you know, history provides us with plenty of evidence that people have been interested in sexual representations even before there was any, paper means or electronic means of making sexual imagery. So it's clearly very important to people. And because it's so important, of course, there are others who would like it not to be available. So, you know, of course, where you have people making sexual images, you also have those who say that these are wrong. And for a variety of reasons, moral reasons, religious reasons, and just plain disgust, actually, that's often a big response to pornography, is that, you know, this is disgusting, I don't like it, I just think it's all.
Dr. Smith, you are clearly a woman. Your interest is in pornography, and the pornography industry has for many, many years been labelled by some feminists as being disempowering of women. What would you like to say on that matter?
Well, I think that, you know, it still remains very true that a lot of the material is made by men and with men's interests in mind. However, you know, that's changing. But with access to, new digital technologies, it means that anybody can actually produce pornography and that people can access it as well. Anybody can access it. And there is growing evidence that actually women are interested in pornography and that they wish to make their own. They wish to see their own interests reflected there. It's not just women, though. It's also sexual minorities, you know, what have been called sexual minorities. Clearly those are not such a minority case. When one looks at the internet, you can find massive amounts of gay pornography, which suggests that actually that's not a minority case at all. And women, straight women as well as gay men, are looking at that material, as well as men who would identify themselves as straight. So, you know, there's a big realm out there of materials being produced for people who have in the past been understood to not have particular interest in pornography or to being, you know, the subject of it in ways that were supposedly not conducive to their well-being. I think, you know, the arguments about women being dumbed down by pornography are a less reasonable argument now as the porn industry is opened up to new producers and to women making their own materials and also to women as consumers. So it's much more fluid than might have been argued in the 70s and 80s. But of course, there are still those who make the argument that pornography is harm to women. Harm, of course, is seen as a particular kind of use of the materials. And the research that we're doing is to try to see whether or not, you know, those questions are the right ones to be asked. We suspect that they're not. And that actually we should be asking the kinds of questions about how porn is important to people and what place it has in their lives.
Now, this is a project that you have been trying to get off the ground for some 10 years. Why has it sort of come about now, this reason for the motivation behind the consumption of porn, rather than looking at the other end, which is the production of it?
Well, I mean, one of the, you know, the forces of censorship, you know, those people calling for censorship are constantly arguing that there are very harmful effects of pornography. Addiction is one thing that they talk about. Of course, that's a very problematic term to use in relation to pornography. The research really is designed to do something different, to really investigate how and why people use it. Because although, you know, that it's not as if porn has, this explosion of porn that I've already talked about has happened in a vacuum. It's happened at the same time as there have been all these discussions about the harmful effects of pornography, and still people want to look at it. And we're just very interested in what that means to people. Of course, you know, it's been difficult to research the uses of pornography precisely because of the questions of shame and embarrassment about admitting to using porn. But the internet actually makes it possible for people to complete a questionnaire anonymously without any fear of being discovered and, to be able to answer things honestly. So that's what we're hoping we'll achieve with.
Now, you said that the term porn addiction is one that is difficult, I guess, to define. Why do you say that is?
Using the term addiction implies a very problematic relationship with pornography. It implies that you have no control of it, that you can't stop yourself engaging with pornography, and that actually there's some sort of bad effect on you as a result of you using it. But of course, one of the things that's very clear about that deployment of the term addiction, which is being used for things like, you know, addicted to violent movies, to violent games, it's usually deployed by people who don't understand the media form that they're talking about. And actually, if we were to replace the term addicted to pornography with something like experienced viewer of pornography, then we start to think about how people consume the materials in very different ways. So we only use the term addicted for certain kinds of media forms. We don't say someone's addicted to opera or addicted to reading books. Instead, we talk about them as people who are knowledgeable and very interested in those things. And we'd recognise the skills and knowledges that they bring, that they've acquired over time. People develop a particular sense of what an opera is and what they like and what they don't like because they go and view it numerous times and give time over to reading librettos and going to see different companies perform. And that gives them a level of knowledge and expertise that is important. And the same is true of pornography.
I think that is an extraordinary definition and a great way of separating the two. And what you were talking about is an empowered reference rather than a judgmental reference.
Yes, absolutely. That is our working through this actually is thinking that this is a... I mean, I think the term empowerment is rather problematic too, but I think the ways in which people learn what they like and what they don't like is really important, and that they have practices of discrimination as well, you know, that they it's not just about seeing anybody having sex in pornography, it's about wanting to see particular kinds of sexual acts or particular kinds of people engaging in sexual acts, having particular ways of thinking about the aesthetics and what one likes and what one doesn't like. And I think that's really important now for us to be thinking about in terms of how people use pornography. Because certainly there's that in terms of production, that there are lots of different kinds of pornography available now. And it's not just simply one sort of pornography. There are, you know, vast kinds of pornography to choose from. And we need to think about how and why people make the choices that they do.
Pornography is often referenced as being a fantasy sort of thing, and in that realm it's escapism, it's entertainment. How much of it is voyeuristic in its sense or fantastical in its sense?
Well, I mean, yes, certainly pornography is about fantasy, and clearly, you know, that's something that actually gets lost in some of the discussions about porn, especially where people want to censor it, where they talk about the ways in which it offers very problematic fantasies to people, and that they'll then lose their grip on reality as a result of viewing this material. Well, there's no evidence that that's actually true. And actually, you know, it presupposes that there's a straightforward dividing line between fantasy and reality. But, you know, every other kind of media we accept offers ways of thinking about our world, ways of understanding ourselves, ways of relating to other people, and that these are complexly related to our own sense of ourselves. But when it comes to pornography, some people talk about it as a kind of documentary form, and a documentary form that is really bad, and that's something that, you know, there isn't the evidence for. And we're seeking to find out what it is that people think pornography does for them in terms of their lives, and how fantasy may well be an important part of their lives. And fantasy is really the means by which we imagine ourselves doing things differently. You know, a world in which people don't have fantasy would be a really dull place. You know, you'd never imagine yourself doing anything differently, having a different kind of life, or imagining the possibility of, you know, what it might be like to love someone and to connect with somebody in a world, you know, maybe free of social taboos. So, and that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. It's maybe utopian, but that, you know, what's wrong with a bit of utopia?
Indeed. Now, Dr. Clarissa Smith, is there any indication that pornography actually has some beneficial effect in that people relieve themselves through viewing it, or they don't enact certain things that they would otherwise do because pornography is their release?
Well, I think there's, you know, there's plenty of discussion of that as a, you know, it's called the therapeutic defense of pornography, but it allows the possibility of relieving certain feelings. And I think, you know, of course that's going to be a part of some people's use of pornography. And for sure, you know, when it comes to sexual minorities, that there are possibilities of relating and using pornography in ways that allow you to get out feelings that you couldn't express any other way. And so, for example, the man who identifies himself as straight but has particular feelings towards other men but doesn't feel that that's something that he can actually act upon, you know, gay pornography allows an outlet for that. But equally for people who are in marriages, you know, where they feel that they can't act on their own desires for whatever reason, pornography offers a space in which they can do that. But equally, you know, it's a space in which lots of people can find ways of articulating elements of themselves, you know, a desire for sexual punishment, for example, or being treated roughly, you know, but without actually wanting to engage in those activities themselves. So yes, I think there is an argument that porn relieves feelings that can't be met elsewhere.
We're speaking with Dr. Clarissa Smith from the Media and Cultural Studies Unit of the University of Sunderland in the United Kingdom. We'll be back with more after this.
Hide and seek.
This is Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9, and I'm speaking to Dr. Clarissa Smith, who is at the University of Sunderland in the United Kingdom. She is undertaking a research project titled, well, the website is pornresearch.org, but it's actually looking at the way we as consumers engage in pornography, what motivates us to watch it and what we get out of it. Dr. Clarissa Smith, why is it that this sort of research project is being undertaken?
Well, pornography has become such a big issue, and lots of claims are made about it, especially by those who would like to see it censored. And, you know, one of the things that tends to happen is that they claim all kinds of effects and ways of using. I mean, but the thing is that there isn't any research base that indicates how people use pornography, and so that's what the research is designed to get at, is how often people view it, what they view, when they view, whether or not they have what their particular pleasures are in it, and what are their disappointments. So we're hoping to build a picture of the ways in which pornography fits into people's lives.
There's all sorts of different types of pornography too, because, you know, it's not all super explicit and it's not all really extra hardcore and extreme, is it?
No, it's not. No, there's a vast range. You can find anything now online, including, you know, softcore stories, which are very romantic, very focused on love and engagement between two people. And at the other extreme, you know, that you can find material which celebrates kind of all kinds of practices that are centered really on sex without feelings, etc. So it's, you know, there are masses of materials, and it's photographic, it's video, it's written words, it's everything. Any kind of media form can be used to produce a kind of pornographic story or materials and that people could use.
In fact, some of the so-called hardcore pornography that involves fetish actually contains no sex at all.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, yes. That there are materials that, you know, maybe simply a woman sitting smoking while the camera watches her do. Or, you know, or involves bondage, you know, someone being tied up or someone being spanked in not a terribly, not an overly sexualized way. Yes, it's very clear that there are all sorts of materials that can be labeled as pornography that don't have to involve penetrative sex or even genitals at all.
This research project is in the form of a questionnaire, and it is a worldwide project, is that right?
Yes. Yes, that's right. Yes, it's available online, and we're hoping that we'll get thousands of people to respond. It's not limited by geography, and it's certainly not limited by gender or sexual orientation. We're just interested in finding out who's viewing what and where and how.
And why?
Absolutely why.
And I believe it'll take about 20 to 30 minutes to complete the questionnaire. And when will we see some of the results from this project?
Well, we're hoping by the end of this year to have some preliminary findings up on the website. And one of the things that we want to do is to make sure that actually it doesn't just stay in the academic environment, you know, so that we will be publishing it via the website. But also our intention is to write, you know, not an academic book out of this, but one that is more mainstream and available to the public. Because I think it's really important that everybody gets a chance to take part in thinking about, you know, what is the role of pornography in modern society. I mean, that can't just happen at the level of academic discussion. It needs to be widely held, and so we're hoping that this research will contribute to that.
And I would imagine that if there's some switched-on porn producers out there, they'll be very interested in your research because it might inform the way they make their movies in future.
Yes. Who knows? You know, it's. I think the tendency for most media producers is to think that academics don't have much to. Tell them about the product they do, that they make. But you know, there may well be some porn producers who will take that and say, well, that's really interesting. There's a burgeoning market in, I don't know, young women looking at fetish materials and then think that that might be something that they would want to cater to. That would be a very secondary purpose for us. our real interest is in how we can intervene, actually, in the debate about pornography and, you know, to make some changes, really, to the whole discourse around pornography and the need for censorship. Because it seems to us that, you know, one of the big problems here is other forces of reaction, those people who would seek to legislate against imagination and who want to close down avenues of thinking about sexuality and its representations. And it's, you know, pornography is clearly very important to people and to some people, and those needs to be recognised. And, you know, governments who are seeking to close down areas of the net in order to stop people looking at pornography, they tend to say that it's in the interest of children to do this. But actually, it's nearly always, you know, people who slightly differ from the mainstream, who are hit hardest by this stuff, who become emblematic of the problem. And actually, you know, there's no real reason for that kind of censorship. And that's one of the things that we're motivated by, is a desire actually to intervene in those debates and to say that the arguments about harm actually don't have any real basis in evidence or fact. In fact, they will be the wrong way of talking about pornography.
And I think the current ways of censoring things are in fact fighting a losing battle. They would be far better to relook at the way in which that they do it. And perhaps this research might bring, like you say, some of the discussion around that point.
Yeah. I think one of the problems, you know, I don't know whether it's the same in Australia, but certainly in the UK, there's been lots of discussion about young people accessing pornography, with, you know, statistics bandied about that 80% of 14-year-olds have accessed pornography. But we actually don't know what they're looking at or why they're looking. And, you know, for many people, it may well be about some form of sex education, in which case, you know, it really behoves governments to think about how do we provide good sex education for young people so that they don't have to go looking for that material in terms of pornography. But that's not to say that they shouldn't actually be looking at pornography. You know, there may be various reasons why they're looking at that material. And I think, you know, censorship is such a blunt instrument and always hurts the least powerful people in society whenever it's up in operation.
And in the same instances, it allows things to get through the cracks.
Yes, always. Always produces things that it would rather weren't there. So, you know, we just get more and more censorship rather than less. It never stops with just one act. you know, it then goes on and on.
Now, if you would like to participate in Dr. Clarissa Smith's amazing research, you simply go to the website pornresearch.org. That's pornresearch.org, and click on the relevant links to the survey, and you can participate as to why it is you watch what you watch and what you get out of it as an individual. Dr. Clarissa Smith, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Dean. It's a pleasure.
Hide and seek.
It's your show for exploring sex, sexuality, and self. On Joy 94.9.
Sponsored by Manhouse. Leather, rubber, lifestyle. Manhouse.com.au.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.